Happy Tuesday, everyone. It's your host, Steve Mace, on Derek, Willie and Derek, Derek and Willie, Mason Willie, Mason Donick, whatever you want to call us. We are here today, and we got a bunch of things lined up for you, a bunch of stuff to talk about, getting some Titan stuff, as we usually do, some Predator stuff. And then we're going to kick it around and talk about some NFL stuff. We got Tim on again, as we usually do around this time of the week on Tuesday. So we have Tim on. We have Alex Carrier today.
We do. Alex Carrier, who decided to re-up with the Nashville Predators, is going to join us at 1 o'clock. So we've got some really good stuff. Tim Hasselbeck, always good to talk football with. And Alex Carrier is a great talker and interviewer. Can't wait to hear what he has to say about that whole process, because he was one that decided that I'm going to stay. He could have hit the market. We talked about it pretty detailed in the weeks leading up, that he would probably have the choice to take a little less and stay where he knows where he fits. He knows the coach. He knows the defensive partner he's going to have, who's a very close friend of his. Or he could hit the market and probably get more money, but be in a little bit of an unknown situation. What is better? I think it's a great philosophical question to kick around. D-Mace, you were kind of left no choice at one point in your career where you were cut, so you knew you had to go somewhere else. But I think it's something that a lot of players face. And sometimes I ask the question, is it worth a certain price to stay where you know you fit, even if you're making a little less? Do you make it on the back end by taking it a little less, because it maybe lengthens your career? I see it with a lot of wide receivers. Drew Bennett is a good example. He got good money. Corey Davis is a more recent example of Titans who they hit the free agency. They got a big raise in pay, but their production was never quite the same because they didn't fit in the same role. It's hard to always recreate. I guess we'll find out with Calvin Ridley and
Tyler Boyd
this year.
And Pollard.
Sneed,
even though that was...
Now, some of those guys maybe didn't have a choice to stay. I don't know. But I think there are times where you could choose to stay and take less.
Or
you can get more, but you're going into the unknown. And Carrier is a great example. We'll talk to him about that process. He's very engaging to talk to. We'll also find out if anybody... got him confused with UC Soros, because they both signed new deals. If people congratulated Carrier, but they were thinking it was Juice. He always has funny stories about that, because that happens to both of them.
I'm sure
they look kind of alike.
He'd take Juice's money.
It's about double.
Exactly.
You can ask him that. We'll see.
He'll contract.
Probably have a funny answer.
According to Nick Kieser, he said Alex Carrier is in the process of getting married. So
yes, and I think Lozon, is that right, Nick? I think they're both getting married. Right? They're obviously very close friends. Their wives are close friends. They had a hilarious
Same
Halloween costume.
Different times, by the way.
Okay.
So Nick Kieser's got all the insight.
He's got all the insight.
Nick got all the tea, man. Keeping his ear to the ground, huh?
The reporter is he does the hustling, man. He's in the locker room. He's talking to the guys. There was a funny picture of those guys. They went all out into the French, you know, the berets that the French wear. They wore like matching costumes. The wives wore matching to the Halloween party. It was hysterical. So those two are inseparable, really.
Okay,
so that would have been the weird thing, is you would have been leaving your guy, right? Your defense partner, close friend, Jeremy Lozon. The chemistry on the ice between them, they fit together very well. So that was something I'm sure he weighed.
Yeah, you had to. You know, the grass, as you know, as they say, the grass isn't always greener on the other side. But you don't know until you test it out. And in a situation, he didn't want to see how green the grass possibly was on the other side.
And he waited to the last minute, because it didn't get done until, I mean, we didn't even hear about it until the day of free agency.
Exactly.
You were hearing behind the scenes they were working on it, that it was going to get done. So he must have thought about it for a while.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. Any player in that situation, there are a lot of things you got to weigh. And I'm sure, you know, playing here, for a considerable amount of time, being, you know, having your line partner, Lazan, and then not only is he your line partner, but he's one of your good friends outside of the rink. All those things you take into account when you're thinking about possibly re-signing with the team or moving on. And I'm sure, you know, his family, you know, had some say in it, whether he goes or not. But sometimes, you know, just because your family wants you to stay, you may not be able to stay. But, you know, the Predators wanted him here and he wanted to be here. You know, you don't know how much he might have left on the table had he left and went somewhere else. But that's something you can't think about. This, once you signed the contract, you signed it. You can't think about it. Now you just got to move on and continue to get better at your craft. And, you know, I'm sure those are the things that he weighed in his decision to, you know, stay here as opposed to trying to test the free agent market.
The other thing that I'm curious your perspective on, this is something else we got into. And I think L'Jarius Sneed, of course, he got traded. This was a situation that came to a head because the Chiefs, in the salary cap situation they were in, they decided this is the move they have to make. Mm-hmm. They probably could have kept him, but it would have forced them into other financial decisions they didn't want to have. So he's making a lot of money. Now, there's a lot of examples of this, but I think about this with Carrier because he could have gotten into a situation where he's the guy that's being paid more, but so much is expected of mm-hmm. him. And sometimes that can be a spotlight that's tough on a player, right? We've talked about that with Sneed. It came up yesterday when you were saying, you know, he's the guy that they can't lose. If he plays 17 games, it's going to make a big difference. But he's going to be under the microscope probably more so than ever before because he's making more money. There's a lot of other examples in sports, but when you sign that, when you're the new guy and you're being paid really well, so much is expected. And if you're not living up to that, you have to deal with that noise that's coming.
Yeah, you're going to have to. There's, you know, when you talk about certain things when you enter into the professional leagues, and the young lady Taurasi said, you know, long ago when Caitlin and those girls were coming out, hey, listen, there are levels to this. It's true. It's the same, you know, with hockey and football or whatnot. There are levels to this. And I bring that up because a guy like Lazan, when you're not making the top dollar, they don't expect – they expect you to go out there and play and get the draw. But there's a level of expectation that comes with the dollar amount that you're being paid.
Yeah, people aren't going to say, well, that guy's really overpaid. I don't know what the deal is with those guys.
Exactly. You know? So and when you get into a situation, you know, like Lazan, do you even want to go? And maybe this is sort of an oxymoron in a sense. Because you never think of not an NFL player, but just a professional athlete not wanting to go and get the max dollar somewhere. And also not just getting the max dollar, but welcoming the pressure that comes with it. You know, it's sort of an oxymoron to say, well, guys don't want to do that. You know, guys don't want to leave and get paid more. And then comes the extra added pressure. That's what professional athletes are supposed to be, right?
Right.
They're supposed to want that pressure. They're supposed to want to be able to shine through the pressure that is being put on you. But some guys aren't like that. Some guys would rather just be in the background. Some guys would rather be the highest paid player but not have all the responsibilities of the highest paid player because they don't know how to react when that pressure's on them. Other players love it. They want the pressure. That helps them thrive. And, you know, maybe Lazan, you know, Carrier.
And down the road, Lazan.
It's going to be Lazan, too.
He's going to have that same kind of decision.
Are they the type of players? I'm sure they are, but are they the type of players that would rather just, you know, go out there and just play their game, don't worry about anything else, don't want that added pressure, just go out there because they feel they play better at that, you know, at that level? Or, you know, are they the guys that want to go out, get the max contracts or welcome the pressure?
The other part of it is on a salary cap team, especially a strict salary cap like the NHL is, unlike the NFL and to an extent the NBA, where you have a little bit of wiggle room, you can make it. But if you take less, you can also rationalize it by saying, I'm giving my team a chance to win. I think UC Saros did it by taking 7.74. He probably could have waited it out, played it all the way to the end of next year. Maybe he got a, maybe he would have gotten traded as a result, but he could have walked up to free agency and probably made more by hitting it. But I think he wanted to stay. He was willing to take a little less with the idea that it gives my team a chance to have more resources to fill out the rest of a winning roster. You can rationalize it that way, too. Because I think Alex Carrier, realistically, is he's probably – and I will throw Lauzon in there too. Are they an ideal second pair on a championship team? Probably not. They're somewhere between a good second pair and a great third pair. So if you could, if that allows your third pair to be great – or eventually maybe they slide down and are a great third pair and there's a, another two guys that somewhere down the road they get, Brady Shea being part of it, I think that gives you a stronger team. And you're playing in the role that is puts you in a position to really succeed.
Yeah, and that's what you have to, I think as athletes, that's what you have to figure out and realize. Am I in the right position to succeed and excel as a player? You know, whether it's being a starter on the first line, the second line, the third line.
Like when you think of Drew Bennett, right? You play Drew Bennett was a great compliment to you for a couple years where he you were probably getting a little more attention than he was, but he was making the defense pay with matchups. And at the end of the year, you guys were both very successful. When he got the money to go to the Rams, it's hard to really remember big moments that he had. I don't know if they expected him to be the number one, but he clearly was in a different role, different situation, and it just didn't click, right?
Yeah, and that's what, you know, that's why.
But he got paid.
But he got paid. That's why I talked about, you know, that's why I made that sort of with Carrier. You know, guys, if they do leave and get more money, do they want that responsibility or do they want to take less and just, you know, just they're comfortable in the responsibility sort of lane that they're in if they stay with their old team. And maybe Lauzon thought that way. But, you know, it's what I've learned in this, in, you know, being in this profession 15, 16 years is that, you know, everybody is not meant for the number one role. Everybody's not meant for it. Some people are meant to play that second fiddle. Some people are meant to, you know, just sort of do their job and not get all of the fanfare and all that other stuff. And some guys think that they want it, think that they're ready, and then when it's thrust upon them, they're not ready. That's what organizations try to figure out. That's what fans want to know. Like, okay, yeah, that guy, he's the second guy. He's putting up numbers. Man, y'all can get rid of the first guy, and y'all can insert him in there. It doesn't work like that all the time, you know. Some guys and girls are meant to be that second option rather than that
complimentary
first option. Exactly, because the complimentary player or the second option, they have – there's a pressure to them, but it's not like the pressure of being the number one guy, because the number one guy is always asked to do everything. There's not any margin of error for the number one guy. For the second guy, there's some margin of error there, because you always think, well, we always got the first guy. If the second guy doesn't, you know, work out or doesn't play the way we want him to play that particular game, we can always defer to the number one guy. When you become that number one guy, if you're not ready, you may not ever, and I mean repeat, may not ever get that number one spot again.
I think we can. There's a lot of examples of pitchers in baseball that were the number three or number four starter, had a couple great years, got paid big as a free agent to be a number one or number two,
and they're not.
But they're not quite that. They're the same pitcher. They're just getting paid more. So there is. It sounds weird to say, but it's like ironic to say there is a price to be paid for being the overpaid guy. And in this case, I think Carrier chose to stay with what he knows he's comfortable with.
Exactly.
So we'll talk to him at 1 o'clock about that. We've got Tim at noon. We've got a really good topic here in the first hour, because how many times, and look, this is going to be the theme until they get it right, did they fix the offensive line for the Titans? We had an interesting interview with Hall of Fame offensive lineman Steve Hutchinson. I think there's probably some people here in town that probably, even though he's in the Hall of Fame, don't remember him playing for the Titans, which he did at the end of his career, because he's much better known for his days as a Seahawk, where they went to the Super Bowl. That was the great year that Sean Alexander had, and Matt Hasselbeck and that team. Not the Legion of Boom, but the other Seahawk team that made it a few years before that. They lost to the Steelers, Jerome Bettis and those guys. And he also played a number of years, Hutchinson did, in Minnesota. So a great career. Ended it with the Titans on a team that really didn't go that far. I think Munchak was the coach. It was just one season.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Think in that range. All that being said.
Or was it Wisenhunt?
I think it was before Wisenhunt. I feel like it was when – we'll have to look it up exactly. Yeah. But he stayed in town. He lives here. Got elected into the Hall of Fame here in the last couple of years, but still does some consulting work for the Seahawks. He's a good buddy of Hal Gill's, and when Hal was co-hosting a couple weeks ago when D-Mace was on week one of his European tour, we had him on the show just to talk some football. And I didn't even realize he was doing some evaluating for the Seahawks, but we just asked him about J.C. Latham. And Bill Callahan and some offensive line stuff. And we got some great answers. So we're going to play those for you when we come back. We're just getting it cranked up. So we've got a lot coming here on the show. You're going to want to hear this, because you've heard a lot of people questioning J.C. Latham. Can he switch from the right side to the left side? Why was he the pick? You know, I thought they were going to take Joe Alt. He wasn't there. Should they have taken somebody else? All of these questions. I think you'll be curious to hear what Steve Hutchinson had to say about Latham exactly. Plus, what is the value of a good offensive line coach? How much difference can a guy like that make? Because that's what everybody is banking on with Bill Callahan in the Titans. So we'll have that for you. Tim Hasselbeck at noon. Alex Carrier at 1. So we've got a great lineup show. Plus, one other topic we're going to tackle today is Sidney Crosby is about to turn 37 years old, and the report is out of Pittsburgh he is going to re-up with the Steelers. He's not going to play for the Steelers. I'm yo-yoing back and forth between football and hockey. This would be the Penguins. He's got three rings.
Re-up with the Steelers, then he's a bad man.
He's a pretty good athlete. You never know. The Steelers need some help, right? That might mess up the Steelers' salary cap a little bit. But he wants to be that guy that goes from start to finish with the same team. He values that. But are the Penguins being a little bit too sentimental with this? Even though he's still a great player, he's 37, we're going to tackle that issue, because the Titans weren't sentimental with Derrick Henry. The Lightning weren't super sentimental with Steven Stamkos. So what's the right play for the team? Is this the right move for the Penguins? Because they're not a contender right now. They've missed the playoffs the last 2 years. We know, I mean, 8 teams from each conference make the playoffs. They haven't made it the last 2 years, not even to the playoffs, let alone be a first-round exit, which happened to them, I think, the previous year, the last time they did make the playoffs. So they've been a while since they've been a contender, yet he wants to re-up. The Penguins want him to re-up. They've got an older team, so what do they do? They're kind of in limbo here. We're going to talk about that issue of what's the right move for the franchise and for the player when you got a special case like that. And the Titans were faced with that with Derrick Henry. We're going to tackle that later in the show as well. We're broadcasting from the Busy Bee Heating and Air Conditioning Nashville Studios, the Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. We'll get it cranking. We'll talk Titans O-line when we come back.
And it's like, you'd be amazed how many kids coming out of college don't know how to get in three-point stance and offensive linemen, because they play in some kind of fast-paced air raid type offense where it's just kind of throw the ball 100 times a game. And, you know, fundamentals and technique and the basic things that everybody was taught 20, 30 years ago, they kind of just rely on athleticism a little bit now and just kind of bypass all that. And then when you get to this league and everybody's a great technician on top of skilled athlete, it's, you got to go back to a foundation. And I think a guy like Bill is going to teach all the right steps in that order for these guys to have a chance.
That was Steve Hutchison, former Seattle Seahawk and former Tennessee Titan. And he was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. What was it, two or three seasons ago?
I think it was 2 years ago.
Two years ago?
And he was knocking on the door for a while. That's a whole process that's interesting. But, you know, I think it was – I wanted to know because I think, you know, we take for granted that – a lineman would say, yes, the offensive line coach makes a difference. Like, in baseball, I always note that the number one fall guy when a team isn't hitting is always the hitting coach. Mm-hmm. Show me a team that's not hitting, the first move that the team usually makes is to can the hitting coach. Well, I think you find out that in baseball, sometimes some hitters don't really want to talk to the hitting coach very much. They wanted to, especially if they've had success, they don't want to mess with it. They've got their way of doing things, and they don't need to hear a whole lot from the hitting coach. The hitting coach, the last thing he wants to do is screw up your style. Now, it's a little different in baseball because we're talking about individuals, whereas an offensive line coach, you're trying to mesh together five guys. But Steve was really talking about how a guy like Callahan can make a difference. And so that gives me a little more confidence with the biggest question outside of the quarterback, you know, do they have the quarterback, is can they fix the offensive line, which has been a mess the last 2 years. So at least I feel a little hopeful, a little more hopeful after hearing from him that the Callahan thing is real, because I think that is going to be a big spotlight because the special relationship, the circumstances with him being the son of the head coach. But there's a lot riding on that.
Yeah, there is. You know, I think there's more riding on, and you know, this is only my opinion, but I think there's more riding on Bill Callahan getting the offensive line together than Brian Callahan, you know, having this great first year. Because to me, the only way that he can have a great first year is if Bill Callahan gets the offensive line correct. You know, so to me, listen, Brian has a lot of responsibilities being a head coach. But I think Bill has the ultimate responsibility because his offensive line has been putrid the last 2 years.
Yeah.
It's been awful. So whereas Brian, he has the responsibility of the whole team and organization. Well, let's just say the whole team. Because I think Rand has responsibility of the organization at
sure.
this point. But I think Bill Callahan's, his job in this certain situation, I think it needs to, we need to know with him quicker than we do need to know with Brian as the head coach. We need to know that this offensive line is fixed this season because of Bill. Rather than knowing if Brian is the guy. Listen, we don't want Brian to come in and go 0-17 or 8-9 somewhere. We would like for him to have a good record and to get in the playoffs. But none of that can happen if Bill doesn't fix the offensive line, point blank.
We will all feel so much better about the direction of the team if the offensive line gets done. Because it's not only that you're trying to make it happen with a bunch of nobodies. They have now put a pretty big investment over the last 2 years in that offensive line. Last year with Skoronski, and then this year with Latham as the left tackle and the free agent pickup of Cushenberry. Mm-hmm. So you want return on investment. Now, those two guys on the left are very young, but you have to hope that you hit on those picks. And that's where Callahan, hopefully, can speed up the development process. And you need a little bit of luck with the health of those guys. So I sometimes like to believe from afar that if a guy's an offensive line coach in the NFL, he must be good. There can't be that much variance between whatever you think is the best offensive line coach and the worst offensive line coach. I just think all those guys to get hired at that job have to be pretty good. But I may be wrong. Like what did you think? Like you had a lot of different receiver coaches. Mm-hmm. Was there a wide range of guys that you learned a lot from, as opposed to guys that maybe you didn't, and you were like, "Well, how did this guy get the job?"
No, I think every guy that I had, and with the exception of probably Coach Lowry. It wasn't that Coach Lowry, I didn't think he was a good coach, but Coach Lowry had the responsibility of the special teams as well.
Okay.
So he had not only the wide receivers, but he was doing special teams, I believe, when he was coaching the wide receivers as well, if I'm not mistaken. So that may have been the only coach that I'm not going to say I didn't learn a lot. I didn't learn anything, because I did learn from him, but he had dual responsibilities, I believe, that first year, if I'm not mistaken. So his mind was sort of being pulled both ways, both on the special teams as well as the receiver coach. But then after that, I mean, every receiver coach that I had the pleasure of, you know, being coached by, they all taught me something different.
Okay.
They all taught me something, you know, that helped me further my career. I don't think I ever stepped into a room even in college, I don't think I ever stepped into a room where I didn't think that the guy that was coaching me wasn't doing a great job at helping me hone in on my skill.
So that's why I'm a little careful, because I'm not sure that it's fair for Bill Callahan to be Mr. Magic, right, to instantly turn these guys all into the greatest offensive line of all time. But I feel like the expectation level is very high with him and his track record. And I'm guessing he embraces that. Mm-hmm. He wants that challenge. But he has been given some pretty good talent to work with, at least on the left side, right? The right side is the real key. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But what I wouldn't want to see, if I'm Brian Callahan, is halfway through the year, if the offensive line is still struggling, is all the heat and the noise that there would be if Brian Callahan's being asked, well, what's going on with the offensive line? You brought your dad in.
Yeah, that's tough.
They're supposed to be much better. They're not getting it done. What's going on? Mm-hmm. You know, that's potentially what you could see, because the expectation level is so high.
And that's why I said what I said at the beginning, that out of all of these coaches, I think, and listen, it's just the way it is. You know, I think right now at this particular moment that Bill Callahan's job is going to be the job that everyone is watching.
Yes.
That everyone is sort of scrutinizing whether these guys are getting better or not. They're going to be looking at this position like no other position. Not to say that Brian Callahan doesn't need to get this team going and show some progress, but they can't show progress unless the offensive line is fixed.
Right.
That's why everybody's going to be looking at Bill Callahan.
That's the catch 22, because sometimes I think the assumption has been the last couple years that the offensive line coach has been deficient. Mm-hmm. They've had a couple different guys, and that was a problem. And maybe it was. Mm-hmm. But I will sit here, I can tell you that I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not the guy that always just assumes, well, offensive line isn't good, they must not be very well coached. Mm-hmm. But that's an assumption that a lot of people make, fans, media, etc., from the outside. And I don't know if that's always true. Like, even though you don't know the name, the name of the offensive line coach may not have a lot of street cred, it doesn't mean that he doesn't know what he's doing. That's what I worry about a little bit, is that I think there's a perception that Callahan is going to be way better than his predecessors. Maybe that's true. That's why I value what Steve Hutchison said there, because he does think he is a difference maker.
Yeah.
But what's realistic is my question.
Well,
and it certainly helps if you got some Jimmies and Joes in there. Like the last guy, he didn't have Cushenberry.
Yeah, he didn't have them.
He didn't have Latham, right? He had,
Dillard.
A hodgepodge.
He had, you know, other guys in there that just
Duncan
that just couldn't get the job. I'm done. And listen, Hutch talked about this in the interview about, you know, having that coach. Like, the offensive line takes the personality, takes on the personality of their coach. And I think that's true. Because I look at, you know, when I was here and we had dominant offensive line, Mike Munchak was the head coach. Mike Munchak was the offensive line coach. Mike Munchak is a Hall of Famer. Mike Munchak go about his business a certain way. He's a no-nonsense guy. You know, he teaches technique. He's big on technique. And then you watch our offensive linemen, and they were the same. They were no-nonsense guys. They were about their technique. They were about going out there and playing physical. They didn't say much. You know why? Because their head coach didn't say that. That was his personality, and they took on his personality. That's what this offensive line must do. They must take on the personality of their offensive line.
I thought
coach.
That was a great point that he made, that it does take on the personality. That is where an offensive line coach can make his mark.
Exactly.
The line buys into his thing.
His philosophy, the way he thinks, the way he approaches, you know, the game, how he teaches it. And, you know, if Bill is a technician, he's all about technique. What Hutch said about Latham, this should be a marriage made in heaven. You know, Bill loves technique. Latham, Hutch talked about Latham and his technique. You know, how he's a technician when it comes to a big guy that can move that well, but also is a technician. You know, so those two guys should be hand in hand. It's like hand in glove.
Well, let's hear what Steve Hutchinson had about Latham, because we all remember, and this was one of the early Avenger moments of the summer, is because, A, on draft night, Jared was doing our coverage and D-Mace was on the panel, and Jared freaked out on the microphone. We played the promo all the time. We don't have to play. Oh, no. Why did they pick this guy? And there's been a lot of discourse, a lot of questions, and they are fair questions. Is number one, was Latham worthy of being the seventh pick? Because he wasn't in a lot of the mock drafts. It shows you how different it can be for a team as opposed to those that put together mock drafts, and those people work very, very hard to do it. But it doesn't mean that that's how the draft is going to flow. And the other part was, did he have the – remember, D-Mace went on a tirade about questioning the body type, right? Jared, Joe, Rex Road even was questioned, does he have the body type to be a left tackle as opposed to a right tackle? And your response was?
Yeah.
Quite high style.
Exactly. I was very adamant that day about, you know, because if you're basing it – If one of your biggest sort of apprehensions is his body type, get the hell out of here. Body, what? That's why you're so worried, is because of his body type? If you listen to everybody that have talked about J.C. Latham, the one or two things that they always say about this guy, one, they talk about his power and him being aggressive. But then they talk about how a guy that big can move. Like he's from side to side, lateral movement and up the field, he moves like no other. He's a big guy. You don't see big guys moving the way he moves. So when I hear that, I don't think body type. I just think he's a good athlete. A good athlete, you could put anywhere, and they will figure it out.
That's why I knew you would really like what Steve Hutchinson had to say, which is why we're doing this today. And I immediately sent this interview to Jared, who's on vacation this week, but I would love to know.
I'm glad you interrupted
if this
vacation.
Assuages. No, I did it before he went on vacation.
Dang it.
I wanted to know if this has assuaged his doubts, because, you know, Jared, he's going to stick to his guns. Mm-hmm. He's going to keep making this a thing until he is proven wrong. But here's what Steve Hutchinson had as an evaluation, first and foremost, about J.C. Latham. Now, keep in mind, Steve Hutchinson, this isn't just him from his couch.
Exactly.
He is evaluating for the Seattle Seahawks the draft prospects, and this is what he had to say about Latham.
The lineman,
coming out every year. That's kind of part of my job for Seattle, and he was my top guy on the board. So, you don't really see guys that size that can move and play with technique. So, you know, we've spent a lot of this segment talking about all that. Like, this guy's kind of got it all. And I think from the few times I've interviewed him and sat with him at the combine and all that, like, guy's wired right. So I think they got a good one. And then, you know, don't write off the kid from last year, Northwestern, Skoronski.
Yeah, Skoronski.
He's a good player. Another good technician. Like, they're building it the right way.
So very optimistic about where the Titans are going. And I think it's good perspective, because even though he played for the Titans and he lives in Nashville, I think he is being honest. I don't think he's sitting there going, well, I live in Nashville, let me say some nice things about who the Titans have. I really think he's a very straight shooter, and he was evaluating these guys for the draft. So he hit on what you hit on. The size and athleticism combo will play in his mind, and he likes his makeup.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, with guys like that, again, when you got a Hall of Famer evaluating, you know, this position, which the position he played, you know, left tackle. I think Hutch was a tackle or guard? What did he? I know he played some guard, and I know he played some tackle, but I don't know.
At one point, he was the highest paid offensive lineman in the game.
Yeah, he was.
I think. I think he is listed as a guard.
Okay.
Here. Yeah.
Okay, so he's a guard. I think he played some tackle at times. But you're asking a guy that has played the position to evaluate an individual. And, again, he could have easily said, listen, I had him, you know, high on my board as far as offensive lineman. I had him in my top five, but he wasn't my number one. He could have said that if that was in case the truth. He could have said that. Mm-hmm. He was a top five guy for me. But he went out of his way. It was like, this is the guy that I had ranked number one because of what we talked about, Willie, a second ago. A big guy with the athleticism to move the way he can move. He can play right. He can play left. You know, right now they have him at left, and they plan on keeping him there. And Hutch said he'll figure it out because of his athleticism.
Let's hear a little bit more about what he said, because I asked specifically, because this is the other thing that a lot of people were wondering. How easy is it to switch to the left tackle when you have been playing at the right tackle? And I remember the clip very well, because these are legitimate questions to ask mm-hmm. from the outside. You know, Chad Withrow and Jared, one day I can remember we were having going back through his days at Alabama. Why didn't they ever move him to the left in all the circumstances? Well, here's what Steve Hutchinson had to say about a guy who played right tackle in college moving to left tackle in the pros.
For the most part, these guys know that they just got to hunker down. And when you're young, it's hard. You know, you know it's a different game from the college level. The game is faster. The players are faster. You know, a lot of these kids are doing things that they've never had to do in college. A lot of these, and like what I mean by that is 3-point stance. You know, I do scouting for the Seahawks now, and I kind of work in the offensive line. And it's like, you'd be amazed how many kids coming out of college don't know how to get in 3-point stance in offensive linemen, because they play in some kind of fast-paced air raid type offense where it's just kind of throw the ball 100 times a game. And, you know, fundamentals and technique and the basic things that everybody was taught 20, 30 years ago, they kind of just rely on athleticism a little bit now and just kind of bypass all that. And then when you get to this.
We're going to play more of that clip on the other side, but that is one thing in the context of all this that we touched on also, is it's kind of hard to find offensive line prospects these days. And so when you find one, you want to grab them, because he was just getting into the college game. So many offenses that we see, he said there's a lot of linemen that don't even get into a 3-point stance that you have to, because that's not how it's going to be in the NFL. Right, you're doing things for the first time when you get to the NFL. But I think that's also part of a bigger answer when he looks at guys like Latham and Skoronski, is that they have been prepared mm-hmm. much better for the pro game. And they have some good athleticism as well.
Exactly, because a lot of these guys, even when you're running a football in college, you're set up in a pro stance. Because a lot of these are OP, you know, run option type of run pass type of plays. And, you know, so the offensive lineman can't get into a three-point stand. They got to sort of get into this, you know, pass block or pass pro stance because they don't know if the ball is being thrown. And once they figure out the ball's not being thrown, then they sort of, you know, adjust based upon that. But very seldom do you see, unless you go to schools like Michigan or Alabama, where they're running the football and they're running it out of pro sets at times, especially Michigan. So you saw a bunch of their linemen in three-point stands. But if you go to, you know, say Oregon or I don't know, A&M, Texas A&M, schools that throw the ball a lot, you see these tackles in these two-point stands, pass pro stance, because they know more than likely they're throwing the football rather than running it.
All right, when we come back, we'll hear more specifics from Steve Hutchinson on switching from right to left and the challenges that go with this, and is he worried about Latham? Good perspective from a Hall of Fame offensive lineman as we try to answer the big question. Have the Titans fixed maybe their biggest problem over the last 2 years, and that is the offensive line? D-Mace and I will also get into what we're going to see in camp on the right side of the offensive line. That is where Callahan might have to work some magic, and we'll see if he can get production out of the hodgepodge that's sort of left over from the lines that have not done as well the last 2 years. That's coming up in our next segment. Don't forget, at noon, Tim Hasselbeck is going to join us. We'll talk NFL stuff with him as we got a little summer football show going on. And don't forget, at 1 o'clock, we'll continue to get the fallout, the aftermath of the big moves that the Predators made in the offseason. Defenseman Alex Carrier is going to join us at 1 o'clock. So stay tuned. We're getting it cranking here on 102.5 The Game. This is Willie and D-Mace. What about switching sides? That's another thing that comes up a lot. Latham played on the right side. They want him to be the left tackle. How tough is that?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be a big issue for him, you know, especially when you got a guy that size that can move the way he does, and he plays, like I said, with the technique he does. He's not just out there kind of like just winging it. Like that guy plays within himself, within the scheme, and I think he'll figure it out. He'll figure it out.
Hall of Fame offensive lineman Steve Hutchinson here on Willie and D-Mace, which is brought to you by Zen Sports. Start earning cash rewards on your bets today. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-889-9789. Terms and conditions apply. Must be 21 and up and in Tennessee to bet. Tim Hasselbeck will talk football with us at noon, but we're focusing in on the big issues of the Titans offensive line. It has been their Achilles heel the last couple of years. There's no doubt about it. Wanted to get some good perspective from Steve on that. And so I was a little surprised, D-Mace, that he thought it would be as, I don't know if I would say he thought it would be easy, but he doesn't think it'll be a problem for Latham because of his athleticism and something he noted before when he was evaluating Latham for the Seahawks before the draft is that he has been taught well. His technique is going to allow him to be able to move over successfully. So he feels like he can do it. That gave me confidence to hear him say that.
Yeah, it does. And you know, because this is a guy that evaluated him coming out of college. And I'm sure he spent a lot of hours watching tape. He got a chance to sit down and talk with him. And, you know, he's conveying to, you know, you and Hal that, listen, I don't think you have a problem. And I understand when people hear that, they think, oh, my goodness, he's just going to switch over to the left side. He's going to be fine. He's going to be all pro bowler the first year. No, that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, listen, the transition that he's making, whereas he's going to have to do the work, he's going to have to put in the time, he's going to have to be coachable, but it's not something that I don't think he cannot do.
Right.
You know? It won't happen. The only way it doesn't happen to me is if, you know, injury, one, and if he just turns out to not be a coachable guy, which that one I don't think will happen.
It doesn't seem that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Everybody seems to be raving about his personality and makeup.
Absolutely. And so when I hear Hutch say that, I hear Listen, he's going to take his lumps. He's going to, you know, just like any other rookie, especially going from one side to the other. But because of his athleticism, because of his technique, he'll figure it out. It'll be fine. You know, it may take a couple of games. It may take a half a year. But he's going to figure it out. So don't worry about it. That's what I hear when I'm listening to Hutch. I don't hear, oh, he's going to move over there and he's just going to be an all-pro. I hear, no, he's gonna struggle some because it's the NFL and he's stepping up to another level. But he'll be okay because of the makeup, because of the athleticism.
I think this is a big question, and that is, how quick are we expecting the results? That's the problem that I think they're going to run into. Is there everybody's so starved to get it fixed?
Uh-huh.
But you have a first-year guy and a second-year guy over there. Hopefully, Cushenberry is going to help, and Callahan is going to help. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line that I see is I'm willing to give it time. I'm willing to give it the whole year.
Yeah.
If I know that it's going to solidify those two positions for a long time in particular, mm-hmm. and really those three positions, because you hope that Cushenberry centers can play a little longer. It seems like, you know, hopefully Cushenberry's not just a 1 or 2 year fix, that he can be part of the next really good Titans team. So I'll take some early 4 to 8 game struggles, but they're going to have to go through. I think that's another reason why I'm trying to keep my expectations low for this team. But that is, to me, the long-term question is, I'll take some early struggles if I know that down the road they have hit on these two first-round picks. That's a huge part of the big picture.
And I think that's the way people need to approach it. I know that's not always the case because, you know, if you go back and listen to the interview, which you can go back and
Go to thegamenashville.com. I recommend it. It's great football talk.
It's a really good interview because it gets into other things. Beside, you know, just
for example, he played college ball with Tom Brady at Michigan for 4 years.
So he tells different, you know, stories about his career and what has helped him and whatnot. So, you know, when you have a guy like Latham, the sort of the ups and downs will be there. But he believes that, hey, listen, this guy's going to be all right. You know, a part of it is because of the head, I mean, because of the offensive line coach and Bill Callahan. But then because of, you know, Latham's makeup. And I think because of the university that he came from and what they were teaching them technique-wise. So, you know, Hutch has a different perspective on, you know, not just Latham, but he talked briefly about Skowronski as well. But he has a different perspective on those guys because he knows. And he even spoke. That's why I say you need to go back and listen to the interview because it's a really good interview. Because he even talked about a little, you know, when he was playing, which was when I was playing, you know,
the
generation
you guys are
before
the same
this generation. Yeah. He may have been a couple years older than me, I think. A couple years
pretty
younger.
Pretty close, I think.
Yeah, we're right around. He may have been right around the same
he
age.
Came into the league.
I came 97, so he came
He
what?
Came in 2001.
Oh, so he's, what, 4 years?
Let's see. He is 46.
Yeah, so he's 4 years, you know, behind me. But
you were hoping you were younger than me.
Yeah,
didn't
dang
you?
It, I was hoping I was younger, but I look younger, so that don't matter. No, I mess with you. No, but you know, he just talked about, you know, how there was this patience with individuals, and he talked about the quarterback, but there were patience with certain positions and individuals. You know, it was like he even said it. You know, 3 to 5 years, this quarterback can be ready. Let's just take time. Let's usher him in slowly. We're not going to worry about it. But 3 to 5 years, he'll be ready to go. Now, it's like if you're not ready after a year, we may have to go. We may draft.
The trouble signs go up. The red flags start happening.
We're going to be drafting somebody else.
And after 3 years, if you're not ready, it's over.
It's over. Yeah, so when he – and I think that goes the same for other positions, left tackle or whatnot. There was a time when you could work into being who you were as a player. They give you some grace. They give you a few years to figure this out. Nah, they're not giving you that anymore. It's either you step on the field and you're ready to go right now, or we're constantly looking to replace you somehow, some way. Whereas Hutch is saying, listen, this kid will be okay. He's going to make the transition. He has all the tools that you need to make the transition. He'll be okay. The thing is, will the Titans give him time to be okay? Or if he struggles, are they constantly looking over their shoulder trying to figure out, hey, where's our next left tackle coming from, you know?
Yeah, and boy, I that's not a good way to
no,
be.
No, no, it's
and,
not.
Because they really need him. They should give him some time. And I think in the context, too, of the team, I wouldn't panic if the team doesn't do great this year.
Exactly.
It's really the key is, are you laying the foundation for the next year or two? Because I think you have a year here of, let's see what we got. If you want to call it a rebuild, I don't have a problem with you saying it's a rebuild. I know the team, some people don't like to do that. They're like, oh, people will buy tickets. They won't. No, people are going to watch. They're going to watch the team. This is a rebuild. It's a new era. See what you got. And that's a big part of it on the left side of the line. So great stuff from Steve Hutchison. We're going to continue with some good football conversation in our next segment with Tim Hasselbeck. He will join us here on 102.5 The Game. So keep it right here.